It's the last Monday of the month. It's the last day of the month, as a matter of fact, November 30th. And that means a visit from our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, professor and director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and Professor John Martin, who chairs the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Question about climate or weather? What's going on out there? Give us a call. The number, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Steve, great to see you again.
It's wonderful to be here on this abnormally warm November.
Yeah,
John
yeah.
probably
John,
hates.
Yeah.
Well, no, it's okay with me. We got a winter coming.
We got a winter coming.
Yeah.
Coming
so up. I don't know how much, but we got something coming.
Well, I'm seeing the weather tomorrow's in the Madison area, and I think across a large part of Wisconsin, warmer weather yet tomorrow, 48 degrees.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's been throughout the state, average temperature has been about 5 or 6 degrees above normal.
For this month, and then following one of the fourth, fifth, or sixth coldest Octobers ever,
yeah.
or something like that. So kind of heck.
Up and down.
Hyde. Yep.
Yep. Why do you think? Why do you think it bounces around like
well,
that?
Well, I have some ideas. I don't know if they work for this year, but one of those ideas is in the Pacific Ocean, the tropical cyclone season really reaches a peak in late September, early October. And I think that has a huge influence for ways that I don't fully understand on changing the complexion of the flow in the middle and high latitudes. And that gives us either warm or cold Octobers and Novembers. I think that's part of it.
Huh.
So it's kind of a current research thing worth thinking about.
So, and you guys are both talking about a kind of a warmer winter. And so I don't know if we're...
And so far, it's kind of...
yeah, so far, the whole El Nino, the normal set of connections that come along with an El Nino, and we have a moderate one right now going on in the tropical Pacific, they just have been absent, completely absent. It's been... the month of November has been very complex, perplexing to me on a lot of levels, and especially on that one. We haven't seen the manifestation yet of the El Nino, so it makes my confidence in the warmer and perhaps a little bit less snowy winter start to feel a little shaky. Right now.
Oh, you think?
Yeah, that's just my impression.
He's
right
just
now.
Hopeful.
No, I'm trying to be as objective as possible, as you two gentlemen well know. But I'm trying to be as objective as possible. And the month of November of 2009 did not look like an El Nino winter month. I will say that. And I think I'd get broad consensus in that opinion.
So the Farmer's Almanac may be right.
Right. Yeah.
That's a
actually,
whole
no, they were
story.
Going for a lot of snowfall.
Were they?
Weren't they? I think they
yeah.
were. I think they
I'm
were
still
going.
Not, colder and snow.
I'm not prepared to go there yet by any stretch. It is. It was
scratching your head.
Yeah, I'm scratching my head.
All right. If you'd like to join in, the number to call 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. USA Today carried a picture of the sun rising above Lake Michigan in Door County, and the sun appears to have flat sides. And it's known as a sunrise mirage, is that it?
Sunrise mirage, yep. It's due to the bending of light. I mean, we generally think of light traveling in a straight lines, but as light moves from more optically dense material to less optically, vice versa, it'll bend. And we see this commonly if you stand on a shoreline and you watch light as it enters and leaves water bodies.
Mm-hmm.
The light will bend. So if you stick a pencil in a sink or something, you'll see it look like it bends. And the same thing happens in the atmosphere, except that bending is generally smaller. And the optical density, if you will, of the atmosphere is close to one, but it depends on what the temperature structure of the atmosphere is. If you keep that in mind, then what happens is the following. The atmosphere is stratified, generally warmer temperatures near the ground, and then it gets colder. But sometimes, and I think this was the case on the photo, is you get these inversions where you have colder temperature near the ground, and then the temperature for the next half a mile or so actually increases.
Oh.
And so what happens is as the sun gets on the horizon, the light that's coming from the sun has to pass through a large portion of the atmosphere, basically the whole horizon.
Yeah.
And as it's doing that, it's passing through this stratified form of the atmosphere. And as it goes from warmer to colder temperatures, that light will bend. And the bending towards the top of the sun is different than the bending on the bottom of the sun. And so that tends to take the sphere of the disk and actually squish it and flatten it.
And there you have it.
And there you have it. Yeah. In fact, most of the times, I mean, this bending occurs all the time. It's just that we don't observe it. And in fact, when we see the sun just sitting on the horizon, the sun is actually already below the horizon. It's just that the light that would normally just pass out into space just gets bent around the horizon, and we actually can see things.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Well, Russell in Rio has a question for you guys, so let's go there. Hi, Russell.
Hi. I was wondering, I think it was National Geographic, I read about an idea they had about putting a long pipe from an area of high pressure to low pressure so that you would be able to put a generator of some sort on the other end.
Boy, if you could do that, and I think that that would be quite an engineering feat, if not impossible, you could generate a lot of energy.
The problem is those regions of high and low pressure are moving all the time. They migrate from one place to the other in response to the way the whole atmosphere works. And so I don't know if you could have a permanent outpost where you could put these generators. Maybe climatological spots where there's usually a high pressure difference, you could do it. But those would be the only places where it would even be conceivable to get any benefit from that.
Okay. Would it actually speed up, or would it just stay the constant? I mean, you could figure it out somehow, couldn't you?
Well, the air is always trying to move from a region of high pressure to low pressure. And if you restrain some of the other options that it has in its movement, in other words, make it channel itself through a pipe, then it'll always move from high to low directly. And then if you can have the air moving through the pipe from high to low pressure and put a generator at the end, when it goes through, it'll spin turbines and create energy. It's just that that's probably more of an engineering problem, and the scale of the engineering problem far exceeds the benefit that you'd probably get from it.
Actually, in some ways, wind turbines actually are doing that.
They're taking advantage of the migratory nature of these weather disturbances. They're just not using pipes. They're just catching it.
They're letting the wind, natural wind, due to these pressure differences, make the energy.
Hmm?
Okay.
Thank you, Russell. Appreciate your call. And Tom in Stoddard, we turn to you. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I would like to ask the weather guys whether any undergraduate studies or doctoral theses are being exerted to study the changes in the weather patterns. Certainly our weather patterns have changed here. We didn't have one thunderstorm from out of the west or northwest this summer. Crazy storms other years that would just make you wonder whether your home was safe. And we haven't had that this summer. The prevailing winds have been out of the northeast, or that sometimes it'll change and come, turn around, go back where it came from, winds out of the southwest. But predominantly all night long, there'd be a gentle breeze out of the northwest, and I understand there was a permanent low-pressure system south of the Hudson's Bay all summer long. Thank you.
Sure. Studies such as the ones that you suggest are done routinely, both by undergraduates and graduate students, so there's a lot of different work that's done on aspects of trying to understand how variable certain types of weather are during certain seasons. And one of the primary weather types that we get around here in the summertime is thunderstorms. So people have paid a lot of attention to the interannual, that is from year to year, variability of thunderstorms and their distribution around in regions such as the Western Great Lakes region, probably not Wisconsin specifically, but Wisconsin is a subset of the Western Great Lakes region. And I don't do that kind of research, so I don't know what the current thinking is. But I know there are people who've tried to link the number of tornadoes, which are a product of convective storms, to what's going on in the tropical Pacific, the El Nino, whether it's on or off, various other things like that. So there is an eye towards linking the day-to-day variation in the weather to something on a larger scale than that. And so there, as I say, there's quite a number of studies that are aimed at that kind of problem.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much for calling, Tom. Appreciate your call as well. The coldest temperature for November was 14 degrees below zero back in 1875. What's the coldest temperature in Wisconsin for the month of November?
So, yeah, that's probably the temperature for Madison.
Yeah.
The coldest for Wisconsin is minus 34. The coldest November temperature, minus 34 in us.
Osceola.
Thanks.
Easy for you to say.
Right.
And when?
Late 1800s, 1898.
1898.
So several years after that minus 14.
Yeah.
That's cold. That's cold.
I don't care what calendar it is.
That's cold. That's cold.
I agree with you 100%. Well,
and the warmest temperature is?
84
in Prairie du Chien.
When was did that occur?
That's a good question. That's in 1904.
So
that's quite a range.
That's
94
huge,
to minus 34.
That's a big range. We'll talk about ranges and some other weather issues here coming up with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at climate and weather today with Professor Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and Professor John Martin, who chairs the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Our weather guys. And if you have a weather or climate question, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@WPR.org. We'd love to hear from you. And as a matter of fact, Mike from Madison's online, so let's go right to Mike. Hi, Mike.
Hi, thanks very much for taking my call.
Sure.
This will be probably the simplest question they'll get, but I consider myself a reasonably intelligent person. However, I've never really been able to get my mind around the distinction between relative humidity and dew point. Mm-hmm. So if they could maybe answer it as if they're talking to a 12-year-old, so I can finally get my mind around what dew point really is, I'd appreciate it. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you very much.
The dew point is the temperature to which you must cool the air while you keep the pressure constant before the water vapor that's in the air already will condense into liquid water. And so that's a very good measure of how humid it feels outside. But it's not going to correspond directly to the relative humidity, because the relative humidity is a different measure of the humidity content. And the relative humidity is a measure of what fraction of the possible amount of water vapor that could be held in the air, given its temperature and pressure, is actually being held in the air right now. So on a cold day outside right now, the relative humidity might be 80%, but the actual vapor content is much lower today than it would be on July 15th, when the relative humidity at a similar time in the day might be much lower than it is now. The dew point temperature on that day in the middle of July will be much, much higher, testifying to much higher presence, much more water vapor in the air. I won't have to cool the air very much to get it to condense in that day in July. I have to cool it probably a pretty good amount to get it to condense today, because there's just so little water vapor in the air in the middle of the winter. So I hope that helps. Steve probably can add some clarification.
The only thing I'd add to that is if you're still not making the distinctions, that's fine, because they are also related in the sense that if you are given the dew point and the temperature, you can calculate the relative humidity. And if you're given the dew point and the relative humidity, then you can calculate the temperature.
But only with the use of a fairly sophisticated chart that we use.
That's right, yeah. It's not necessarily an easy calculation.
Yeah, but it can be done.
But it can be done. So in that way, they're also kind of related through dependence on the temperature.
So there's a chart like online or something that a person can look at, or
a lot of we used to be able to do it on a chart because the calculations were kind of a pain, so people would look it up on charts. Now you can go on websites and enter things like the dew point and the temperature, and then compute what the relative humidity is.
Oh, they'll just do it for you.
Yeah, they'll just do it for you.
So you don't really need to know the.
You don't need to know the formula. You don't want to.
But for my money, the one that testifies most correctly, in my opinion, to how much water is in the air and how uncomfortable I feel is the dew point, not the relative humidity.
Yeah, right. The relative humidity, because you have a relative humidity of 90% on a day where the temperature is minus 20.
Yeah, it doesn't
and
mean
a day when the temperature is, 100, and those two relative humidities mean very different things, even though they're the same number.
Very different things. Okay, yeah. But the dew point,
that's a pretty rock-solid measure of how comfortable you're going to feel.
Yeah, I mean, if you're getting a dew point of 75, independent of what the temperature is going to be, that's not going to be.
Yeah, you don't like that.
You're not going to like that.
You're not going to like that at all.
You're not going to like it.
Al in Burlington, it's on to you. Hi, Al.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
What's the average citizen supposed to make out of this whole climate change thing? I mean, there's so many political, social, cultural agendas being whipped back and forth. As scientists, can you help us, you know, kind of sort it out? What kind of sources do we look at? And, you know, it's a very complex question, but it's just, it's incredibly manipulated and flipped around. So if you could make some comments on that for us normal people, I'd really appreciate it. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks so much.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree with you on this. And it's just been complicated further. I think maybe you've heard about this, that there were some emails that were recently hacked by somebody who emails between people who are on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that really raised suspicions among people who are maybe predisposed to suggest there isn't anything to be worried about, that there's something disingenuous going on in the scientific community. These are unfortunate emails. I think the people who sent them back and forth really ought to rethink the way they do their business. But nonetheless, I think what you can say about the climate issue is that there are changes in the chemical composition of the atmosphere that have been wrought by human industry in the last couple of hundred years that have definitely had an impact on the global average temperature. That, I think, is beyond dispute. Certainly, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. Whether or not that is going to manifest itself in the kinds of changes globally and regionally that people are talking about for the next 50 or 100 years, those are definitely questions that are reasonable questions to continue to debate. But I think it's beyond doubt that humankind has had an influence on the atmosphere in such a way as to warm the climate.
Yeah, and with regard to readings, I'd recommend, you know, some of the popular, what I'll call science magazines. Science is one, but Scientific American, the Smithsonian, the National Geographic, those are all lay science, if you will, magazines that when they cover climate change, they do it very fairly. They don't get into the politics of it. The New York Times science section is also really good. And the Milwaukee Journal, does Ron Seeley still write the science section for those
For the
guys?
Wisconsin State Journal, you mean?
No, for the Milwaukee Journal. Ron Seeley used to be a science reporter for them, I think, and that he was generally pretty good, too.
Actually, he writes for the Wisconsin State Journal.
Oh, does he? Oh, okay. Well, he's still good. So, and usually, you know, gives the science precedence over the politics.
Yeah.
There you have it, Al. Thank you. Steve in Madison, we're on to you now. Hi, Steve.
Hey. Question on zodiac lights. Are they connected to sunspots? I spent quite a bit of time in, I was in East Africa for 4 years, and in the latter half of this, in the 1970s, I think we had a setting of Jupiter, Saturn, and Venus all in the western sky, and then if you saw the thin crescent of a moon, along with those three planets and zodiac lights, it was really breathtaking. The lights would rise about 45 degrees in the air or on the horizon, and of course they were about 45 or 50 degrees across the western horizon. But are those connected to sunspots as well as
what are the zodiac lights?
What are they?
Yeah.
Ooh. You're right. Okay.
Sorry. Yeah.
Let's see.
I mean, while you're thinking about the answer to that, one thing that I do remember is that there was a paper a number of years ago. Boy, this must have been in the late '70s, early '80s, where a colleague of mine in Fort Collins at Colorado State University looked at the alignment of the planets with sunspot cycles, and he found that there was a correlation related in about the 22-year cycle where they the planets tended to line up, if you will, and that tend to be related to the sunspots. I don't remember if it meant more sunspots or less sunspots.
But just be related temporarily,
well,
right?
I'm talking
right, related temporarily.
Here. Are you guys familiar with zodiac lights?
No.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. I'm surprised.
I can't even find it on my search on the webs on the web here. So.
Oh, okay. Well, zodiac lights basically this is a phenomenon on the equator where they're very similar to the aurora borealis in terms of
shooting lights across the sky.
Well, not shooting lights, but when the sun sets, it bounces off the horizon. And Well, after the sun sets, the sun actually skims the top of the atmosphere, and it gives an orangish, glowish, reddish hue that spreads out across the Sahara Desert. I mean, if you're on the Sahara Desert and you see these things, it's just mind-boggling. I mean, it just my question was, if those things are connected to the Aurora Borealis, or are they connected to sunspots? Are you familiar with Patrick Moore?
No.
A Field Guide to Patrick. Patrick Moore is really a British astronomer, and he had a very popular program on the BBC for a number of years before he died. And he wrote a book called Naked Eye Astronomy and A Guide to the Planets is another one of his books. And I'm kind of a fan of his. And that's why I called in about the zodiac lights. I thought, you know, this was kind of a...
Yeah, my guess, based on your description and where it occurs, is that it would not be related to the Aurora Borealis, but it might be related, this is what I would think anyway, with regard to the dust associated with the deserts. Because dust likes to, the interaction of the dust particles with light usually means there's an indication of a reddening of the light. It likes to scatter that light. Mm-hmm. And so given that the sun goes down in the atmosphere, sets, as you're saying, that light normally would just go out to space and we wouldn't see it from where we are. But if there's a dust layer out there, then that light that would go out to space intersects that dust layer, gets scattered, and the red light gets distributed across the sky.
Yeah, okay. And I was wondering if that was connected to the, you know, sunspot cycle. That was my question.
Yeah, no, I don't. That wouldn't be. If that's what it is, it wouldn't be connected to the sunspot.
Okay.
Yeah, it would be connected to the amount of dust in the atmosphere.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Steve. Appreciate your call. And another Steve who's on the road. Let's go to him. Steve, hello.
Hey, how are you today, Larry?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, my question is, why does it seem to get colder at sunrise than it does at the rest of the day?
Mm-hmm.
That is a good question. Now, first I'll ask you, Steve, are you sure it gets colder? Is it just something that is different from your expectation?
Well, it seems to me that the temperature actually drops. I've noticed,
okay,
you know, watching the thermometer and, you know, watching the temperature actually drop.
It does. Okay, so it does. You're exactly right about that. I wanted to clarify exactly what you meant, because you're right. When I was a kid, I delivered papers, morning papers in New England, and it used to get me all the time. Why is it colder when I get home a few minutes after sunrise? And not until I went to college did I figure it out. So, or I didn't figure it, I was told. But here's what's going on. All night long, the Earth is losing energy by long-wave radiation to space. Some of it gets to space. Some of it gets re-radiated back to the surface. But there's no incoming solar radiation. So there's only one radiative situation going on, and it's mostly leaving the surface of the planet. The faster it leaves and the longer it leaves, the colder it gets. Not until the sun rises and peaks above the horizon is there any additional incoming radiation to start to work against that tendency. And as you might guess, it's going to take a little bit of time to work against that tendency enough to start raising the temperature. So it's actually 10, 15 or so minutes before the temperature starts to rise, even though the sun has peaked over the horizon. So you're exactly right.
Energy gains versus energy losses.
Yeah,
as long as the losses
budget.
Exceed the gains, you're cool. And even when the sun comes up, those energy gains, as John's saying, have not yet exceeded the energy losses, and so we continue to cool.
There you have it.
Good observation.
Yep.
Well, thank you very much for that information.
All right. And Nick in Beloit, we are on to you now. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Is this Larry?
Yes.
Okay. Really miss you, hearing you and the lady vet on Calling All Pets.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. I had a question as a follow-up on to the questions on relative humidity and dew point. As I understand, one of the meteorologists from Washington, D.C., and I live in the D.C. area or Northern Virginia, the temperature at night tends to try to fall toward the dew point. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Yeah.
But the dew point, and this is a good way to make a first guess at how cold it's going to get overnight, is to look at the maybe 5 p.m., 6 p.m. dew point. if the dew point temperature weren't going to change all night long, it'd be a really good way to make a forecast at night. But the dew point temperature can also change during the night, whether you're the air may be drying out, the air may be moistening, and that'll change the dew point a little bit. But that's a really good idea to use that as your first guess for the overnight low temperature.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for calling. And you can join in, too. It's open lines. We'll get you out pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us, and the email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. What accounts for the lack of snowfall in November? It's the
Jaron likes snowfall, so that's why we haven't been getting any.
I've had my way for 2 years. You mean this month of November?
Yeah.
It's just been the way that the pattern of the flow in the atmosphere has set up. You know, it's hard to we couldn't see it coming. You can't make on the last day of the month, you can't make a definitive statement about why it was the way it was. Maybe it takes some more study. But there's been, as I mentioned earlier in the show, some really weird things have gone on this month of November around the Northern Hemisphere, and I think some of them have fed back into keeping us persistently warmer than normal and relatively dry. I don't think it's even rained very much this month.
Yeah, most of the state is about 50% below normal in terms of precip.
Yeah, so it was a bland month for weather, except if you like it being warmer than seasonable. But to have a better explanation than the fact that it's just kind of the way things work out sometimes, it's too early to say anything more than that.
And we just had a little around Lake Superior. I think there was just a little snowfall there. And on Lake Superior, before we go back to the phones, I was reading. I'm trying to remember where. Because of the warmer conditions in the winter, we're getting less ice on Lake Superior.
Yes,
right.
And that is, in fact,
causing more wind.
It's causing more wind.
Yeah, and changes. Yeah. It's going to change the ecosystem. And that's a study that was done by colleagues of ours in our department, Ankur Desai, Galen McKinley, and Galen's graduate student, Val Bennington, in addition to another colleague, I think, from Minnesota, just published in Science. Yeah, imagine that. If you have less ice on the lake in the wintertime, the lake remembers that all the way through the calendar year and makes it windier in the summertime, and that's going to change currents, it's going to change biology in the lake, and all sorts of other things that we don't know much about yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
very interesting.
Kind of scary in a way.
And that's something I would have expected. I mean, that just seemed to be so counterintuitive to me.
Me too.
That the lake would get a little bit warmer, and therefore you'd get more windy.
Yeah.
Which is like, that's
Exactly the same response. I even asked them, I said, please explain this more to me. They wanted me to talk about this in our annual newsletter, and I said, you got to explain it more to me. I don't really get it because it was so counterintuitive, but it does make sense in the end.
On to Tom in Rice Lake. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. See, I was wondering if the guys could explain the relationship between relative humidity, dew point, adiabatic lapse rate, and how does that all equate to wet and dry bulb temperatures?
That's a lot. All right. I'll do some of it. You can jump in whenever you want.
Okay.
Well, we've done the relative humidity and dew point, but I'll reiterate again because I'll think of some of the things that Steve said. The relative humidity is a measure of what fraction of the total possible amount of water vapor that could be in the air is actually in the air at the moment that you're referring to it. That's not such a great measure of the humidity, in my mind. And it's one that's losing favor, I think, in the popular media, appropriately so, being replaced more often by the dew point, which tells you, to a greater degree, how much water vapor is really in the atmosphere. And it does it by saying, how cool do you have to make the current air that's outside your window? How much do you have to cool it before it'll start to condense the invisible water vapor into liquid water? And if you don't have to cool it very much, you got a high dew point and you got a lot of water vapor content. That's the way that one works. The adiabatic lapse rate is the rate at which an air parcel, a bubble of air that starts at the ground or anywhere else in the atmosphere, will cool as it rises. It'll cool because it's expanding into a lower pressure environment. The pressure decreases with increasing elevation in the atmosphere. And it'll cool at, which quite remarkable, but it can be proved beyond a doubt, it'll cool at a constant rate so long as there's no condensation of water vapor going on in it. And that rate is just shy of 10 degrees of cooling degrees Celsius for every 1,000 meters of ascent. So it's really quite a remarkable thing that that's true in our atmosphere. And then the wet bulb temperature is the temperature that the air will cool to if you evaporate water into it. And that's different from just cooling it at constant pressure and waiting until water condenses as a consequence of the cooling. Oh, and one last thing that's kind of cool about those three, the dew point temperature, there'll be a spread between the dew point temperature and the air temperature, and that'll be, let's say, 10 degrees Fahrenheit on a given day. The wet bulb temperature for that same day will always have a value somewhere between the dew point and the temperature, always, except when they're all three the same and then the air is saturated.
Because knowing all of those variables, you can do a reasonably accurate job of predicting precipitation, correct?
Well, then you also need to know if the air is rising or sinking. If it's rising, then you're going to generate precipitation and condensation out of that water vapor that's in the air. So that's the other key ingredient. You really need to know that, whether the air is rising or sinking.
Do you determine that by difference in temperatures at altitude versus surface, or do you actually have to physically determine what the air is doing as far as rising or sinking?
I think primarily you have to physically determine it, but then you can determine whether or not the air will continue to rise or sink on its own by doing comparisons of the temperature of the air as it rises compared to its environment. And so there's a combination at some level of the analysis, but the primary level of the analysis, you have to know the air is rising or sinking.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. Tony and Madison, hi.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hello.
Good morning.
Hey, well, actually, good afternoon. Geez, I'm a bit behind. The interesting question on my mind is one that I have put to my father, who is a meteorologist over at MKX, and he didn't really entertain the question. I think he was probably busy with real work instead. So I'll put it to you guys. I've been wondering... What is the influence of humidity on like the heating of air? And the reason I was asking the question was generally I was wondering, you know, ambient air temperature is a function of something putting energy there in the gas. And I was trying to ask him, and I'll put it to you, you know, is air that's, say, 40% absolute humidity going to be hotter with the same amount of sunlight than air that had, say, 60% absolute humidity? Is there any function of that? Is there any difference in the ambient temperature with the same amount of energy into the system if we had more or less water in the air?
That's a really good question, and I think John and I here are scrunching our eyebrows thinking about this. And I think it is in some ways because we do have these gas constants, and these gas constants are a function of the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere, and we use those gas constants in doing thermodynamic type calculations. So I think it does, but I'm not having an easy way to explain it.
There's something called the virtual temperature that takes into account the mixing ratio, how much water vapor is in the air in the vapor form, not liquid water droplets. And the higher the water vapor content, the higher the virtual temperature. And it's only a small difference between the actual dry air temperature and the virtual temperature, but it's enough to change the density of the air. And that makes me think that it really is a good way to suggest that, with more water vapor in the air, you would have a higher temperature. And therefore, you'd certainly have a lower density to that air mass, given the same amount of energy input. But it gets more complicated than that.
And maybe we can take that up at the last Monday of the year.
That'll be a good topic.
Thanks, guys. Steve Ackerman and John Martin are weather guys, and they'll be back the last Monday of the year to talk with us again about the weather and climate. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.